All right, Shisha. So I have been talking to you about Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth, the supplement that helps women maintain optimal hormonal levels, with over 50,000 glowing reviews from women worldwide, with 98% of them saying they would recommend it to somebody else. Now you can take those results even further by pairing it with their probiotic collagen protein, which helps restore gut lining integrity, promoting overall hormonal balance. It helps to relieve occasional bloating and gas, reduce sugar cravings. It helps you feel satisfied longer, boost your energy. It helps to relieve occasional gas and bloating, reduce sugar cravings, keeps you feeling satisfied longer, boost your energy, and helps you stabilize those damn mood swings. And because your gut directly affects your hormones, improving gut health can amplify your hormone harmony results so you can feel like yourself again. And so I struggle with brain fog. I'm sure many of y'all can relate. And since I've been taking the prebiotic collagen protein, I've noticed a big difference there, as well as just a lift in my overall energy levels. Happy Mammoth is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows, folks. So right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and Hormone Harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order today with code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That is happymammoth.com. Use code ADULTCHILD to get 15% off today.
So you know that voice in your head that is constantly telling you how to be a better partner, be a better parent, be a better worker, be a better version of yourself? Of course you know that voice. And when I need to tell that voice to shut the hell up, Calm is the tool that I reach for to release stress and find space to breathe. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it is here to help you feel better. If you're feeling like you could use some support navigating this healing journey, get the relief you need with Calm sessions, like their guided meditations to help you work through anxiety and stress, sleep stories, sleep meditations, and calming music to help you drift off to a restful sleep quickly, grounding exercises, including breath work, to help you reset and relax, and expert-led talks to help you handle grief, improve self-esteem, improve your relationships, and more. The Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket with over 2 million five-star reviews. So calm your mind, change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of this show. Get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/adultchild. This is an amazing value. Go to calm.com/adultchild for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library, calm.com/adultchild, and make sure you tell Calm you heard about them from me.
To heal is to touch with love that which we previously touched with fear. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family, and I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. And boy, do I have a banger for you today, guys. I'm so excited for you to hear this. We are diving deep with the one and only Miss Heidi Priebe. She has a big old YouTube channel where she talks about all the topics that we talk about here on this podcast. She is a writer. She hosts retreats, healing retreats. She has a master's in attachment theory. And that is what we will be diving into in a really raw, real, and helpful way. Now, I know that most of y'all are well-versed in attachment theory, but since we are just kicking off a new season of the podcast, I thought we could lay just a tiny bit of groundwork for anybody who maybe isn't as well-versed, anyone who's new to this, anyone who needs a little refresh. And so attachment theory is, it's not just about whether your parents loved you or not. It is really about how they responded to you when you were in distress. So what they did when you cried, when you were scared, when you needed their comfort. Did they consistently show up for you and help you to regulate? Or did they sometimes show up for you and sometimes not? Or did they dismiss you and make you feel like your emotions were too much? Or were they so unpredictable that you never knew what you'd get? And so those early experiences taught your nervous system what to expect from other people. They shaped your window of tolerance. So how much
emotional intensity you can handle before you go into a trauma response, before you go into fight, flight, or freeze. And those experiences developed your attachment style, which are the unconscious strategies that you developed for how to be in a relationship with others. Strategies about whether it's safe to need people or not. Strategies on whether it's closeness or distance that actually keeps you safer. Now, there's four main attachment styles. We have secure, which is nobody here. That doesn't apply, to anyone here. They say it's like 50% of people. I think that's bullshit. And these people learned that, you know, I can trust that people will be there for me when I need them. Then we have anxious, which are those who learned, you know, I'm terrified you'll leave me, so I'm going to cling harder. Avoidant, they've learned I'm safer alone, so I push people away. And then we have disorganized, which is many of y'all listening, because disorganized is very common amongst those of us who experienced complex trauma. And these people learned that you're my source of safety and my source of fear, so I have no idea what the hell to do. And this kind of speaks to that relational paradox that I talked about in the trauma bond episode a couple weeks ago. And so most of the discussion that you see online regarding attachment is very much a discussion from the neck up. It's very much a discussion around symptoms. And I don't think it's honestly very beneficial. You know, like take, for example, the book Attached, which is like the most well-read book on attachment theory out there. The word nervous system isn't in there once. There is absolutely no discussion about trauma. It is essentially just a deep dive into your symptoms without addressing what's actually creating those symptoms. It's like being handed a detailed map of your anxiety without anyone ever explaining to you that your nervous system is in a constant state of threat. And look, like an intellectual understanding does have its value. It's better than walking around completely clueless about why you keep ending up in the same relationship patterns. But if you want actual healing, you know, not just awareness, but real change in how you show up in relationships, you have to go below the neck, because attachment isn't a thinking problem, it's a nervous system problem. So today with Heidi, we are going way beyond just the are you anxious or avoidant conversation. We're going deeper than just the surface level behaviors. We're talking about attachment from a nervous system lens. What's actually happening in your body? Why it's happening, how it got wired that way when you were a kid, and most importantly, how to work with it in a way that creates real change. Okay, this isn't are you anxious or are you avoided? This is what is your body doing, why, and what do we actually do to heal it? So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where we have 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. There is no place out there like this. It's not for everyone, but for the people it's for, it sure is the place to be. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket, that you can access on the web or through an app. We have a 24/7 hour chat. We have tons of subgroups that you can be a part of. This is a place where you can show up exactly as you are, and you will be loved and accepted for that. This is relational trauma, folks. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships. And this is the place where you can do so for less than $1 a day. And I'd like to reiterate, last week in my conversation with Tian Dayton, she talked about the importance of being in a community as part of your healing journey. And I just want to read to you, somebody posted this in our chat today. One of our fellow members, she said, when I started my healing journey last year, I was adamant on in-person therapy. I was so convinced anything virtual wouldn't be helpful, that I couldn't join support groups and wouldn't feel safe. I cannot explain how transformative this space has been. I attend so many of the virtual groups and connected with a new therapy source through this platform that has been incredibly healing. I do understand how in-person feels better in some ways. I wish we all met weekly in person. How cool would that be? But all those hangups about how I couldn't do anything virtual have fallen away, and I appreciate everyone here so much. I wouldn't be where I am today without this space. I think there's something about having people from all over, which you cannot achieve in person, of course, and that makes this space incredible. So you, yeah, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, the person who is adamant on online community won't work, that you won't feel safe,
Well, maybe you're wrong. Maybe you're going to be writing these words in a matter of time, too, of all the growth that you've experienced from being a part of this community. So let's just do it already, okay? You can see the link in the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. Next, give me a little follow on Insta, on TikTok, at adultchildpod. Go to my YouTube channel. If you want to watch this, you want to watch this interview on YouTube, you can go and do that. It's youtube.com/@adultchildpod. You can find a link for that in the show notes as well. Subscribe to my newsletter. I'm sending out newsletters every week on topics that I'm discussing in the episodes, diving deeper into them. This week, I'm going to be sending out a newsletter on disorganized attachment. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Please do it. Thanks. Love you all. This woman needs no damn introduction. Do you know how excited people are going to be to have you on? My listeners, my community members are such a huge fan of you. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about this?
Here. Oh, a little nervous. I feel always a little bit nervous at the start of podcast conversations, even though it's been lovely chatting with you before the show so far. But I like to get that out of the way.
I'd be nervous if I was talking to me too. I'm kidding. So this is where I always start. When did you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought that it did?
That's a great question. I think there's kind of two things in there for me. One is that I thought of myself as quite screwed up since childhood. So that part was not new to me. The thinking of myself as someone who had like some sort of set of issues to work through. I think I can't remember a time before that was in my awareness, but I was probably in my late 20s, when I first started thinking that that might not just be like a kind of moral flaw that I was born with, that the kind of rotating door of things I'd been struggling with throughout my life may have actually had something to do with my early experiences, as opposed to me just kind of coming into the world as someone who, for whatever reason, couldn't seem to cope with life the way other people could.
Like being like just inherently flawed.
Yeah, that was like my story about myself for a really long time. And I actually remember reading a book when I was 28 years old. It's this very like specific esoteric book on all different types of eating disorders. And it was called Fat is a Family Affair by Judy Hollis, who is this kind of very divergent thinker, I think, in the addiction space back in like the 80s. And she looked, and so she worked with people who had addictions, including eating disorders. And she presented the idea, which was for some reason new to me, that most addictive tendencies came about through family systems. So there was something about the environment that we're raised in, and in particular, the way in which we either are nurtured or the ways in which we're not nurtured that lead people to have struggles with any type of substances, but also like addictions go way beyond substances, right? They can be thought patterns, like certain behavioral patterns. And for my whole life, I'd had this kind of rotating door of kind of like mildly OCD-like behaviors at certain points, and then overt addictions to things at other points. And I just kind of had this story, like I am not as good at coping with reality as other people are for some reason. And bringing it into a family systems lens for the first time, and giving myself permission to kind of think of what if all of this stuff that I've been dealing with in my life is not just because there's some inner brokenness to me, but it's actually a reaction to the circumstances of my life or to what I've experienced as I've gone through it or failed to experience, which in the case of like emotional neglect is often a bigger problem sometimes than what overtly happens. And that kind of set my thinking on a whole different trajectory for the first time. Like it kind of opened this door for me into looking at not just what's going wrong in here, but what did not happen around me at the times where maybe there were certain types of development that I needed or certain types of connection or nurturance that I needed that may have actually really impacted my ability to make sense of the world and to cope. So
was it that book? So like, was reading that book the first aha?
You know what it was? And I don't bring the book up a lot because I imagine the title in this day and age might be kind of.
What was it again? It was a gem.
It's Fat is a Family Affair by Judy Collins.
It's a family affair.
We'll get you to do her PR.
That's a family affair. That's good. I love it. God, I'm trying to decide where I want to go. So were you the identified patient?
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, yeah.
At what age were you deemed?
That's a great question. Honestly, I imagine by like kindergarten. Yeah, so pretty young. Like the question of what is wrong with me has been the through line of my entire life, starting from as young as I can remember, just having this idea that there was something about me and the way that I was born that is giving the people around me a lot of trouble and making others very unhappy. And that was a really challenging thought to grow up with, but one that I don't think I could consciously have named until I was at least in my 20s.
So, and feel free not to share, but how was that manifesting in kindergarten? Behavioral issues?
Yeah, I was diagnosed actually with oppositional defiance disorder by the time I made it to kindergarten.
Damn, girl.
And in this like very apt twist of fate, I had this kindergarten teacher who had recently left the military to become a kindergarten teacher and was like so authoritarian. And I have this memory of meeting with her before going into kindergarten and my parents telling her like, Heidi's a really difficult kid. Like you really got to keep your eye on her. And I just kind of remember thinking like, oh, am I? Like, is that true? And I have not a whole lot of memories of kindergarten, honestly, but I do remember that teacher just being like such an authoritarian presence. And it was kind of interesting to me that like, that was my first exposure to adults outside of my home environment. So yeah, it's been a long, long journey of that being kind of the narrative that I was carrying around with me.
Were you sent to therapy at that age? Like how do they treat opposition? What is it again? Oppositional defiance disorder in a 6-year-old?
Yeah, no, I was not.
Still in the DSM? Didn't they?
I don't think it is.
I think they got rid of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so. It was not an official diagnosis. I don't know if you actually can diagnose a child with that. I think
it's dangerous.
Yeah. But it was my parents meeting with someone who I believe may have been, you know, it's funny. This is one of those things where I'm like, when I go back and check on it as an adult, I don't know the answer to who they spoke with that gave them that label. But I remember them telling me about it later on in life and going and looking it up and being like, really? Did that? Like, I couldn't imagine myself at age, I went to kindergarten at age 3.
Damn.
Is that? Yeah. There was something about it that I guess didn't shock me because I already did have that kind of narrative of like, I was a very bad kid online for myself. But I remember
reading. But that's not normal in Canada, right? Like you're like going like, you were like ridiculously smart, but just like horribly behaved. Like she's really smart. Like she's like 3. She's like 3 years younger than everyone else, but she's horribly behaved.
Okay. You go to kindergarten.
Isn't that called being 3?
Yes, actually. Yeah, it is. You go to kindergarten at 4, but okay. I have a late birthday. So I started.
It's like 5 or 6 here. So I was going to say like, of course.
Yeah, I wasn't sent to kindergarten because I was abnormally smart. But it's funny because I do think I started doing super well at school from an early age, in part because I was like, I want to combat this and I like learning. So that kind of became another route that I was able to take was like, okay, I get approval, acceptance, and encouragement at school when I'm just like really focused on being really good at reading or whatever it is that I'm there to do. And that actually did help, I think, a lot in terms of just learning to think of myself kind of differently and seeing myself reflected differently in the eyes of authority figures. So ironically, past that first kindergarten experience, school was awesome for me.
Were you always the problem, like in your family's eye, like throughout your upbringing?
That's definitely the story that I was always told about myself and really bought into for quite a long period of time. And at a certain point, it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Mm-hmm. Like a big problem that I could identify in retrospect once I became an adult and started reading about all of this stuff was that I started very young, just demonizing a lot of my emotions. Like I had this story that anytime I was angry, there was something really, really wrong with the fact that I was feeling that. Or anytime I was sad, if something extremely overt, like a death or something hadn't happened, I was displaying this really shameful thing. And so what kind of ended up happening was I internalized all of these very normal human emotional experiences as wrong and bad and shameful to have. And so then I started repressing a lot of stuff. And then when you're 7, 8 years old and you've been repressing all your feelings, they tend to come out all at once as soon as you get triggered or overwhelmed. So I would have these really bad outbursts or like temper tantrums. And it took me a long, long time in my life to learn that it was actually the repression that was leading to that. And the solution to not having that happen was to actually learn to get in touch with and express those emotions on like a daily basis when they actually occur. But for a lot of my life, I think I was caught in this cycle of like self-pathologizing and telling myself there was something wrong with my inner experience, which kind of ends up making it true in its own right.
Well, I mean, that's the message that you were receiving, you know? So then when was the realization of complex trauma?
That one came a little bit later. Like, I think I read that book when I was 28 years old and I decided like, okay, it's time to do some work on my attachment style. And I had like a little bit of an idea of what attachment theory was. I went online and started looking at things and I was following that thread for about a year. And somewhere in that process, I picked up Pete Walker.
Are you avoidant?
Yeah. Yeah, I figured. Yeah. Complex PTSD from Surviving to Thriving. Mm. And like every page of that book, I was just blown away by like the way in which he described all of these different issues that will kind of stack on top of each other. And it felt like reading a book about my own life. So I got really into exploring what CPTSD meant. And I started going to therapy for the first time in a way that I was actually engaging with around that point in my life and working with a whole bunch of those symptoms and patterns. And there was actually a whole year. It was the year of 2021. I kept that book in my backpack that I would carry with me everywhere because it had these specific steps in it for recognizing when you're in an emotional flashback.
Yeah.
And there was like a year where I was like, I can have a different day every day of my life if I keep this book on me and like open it every time I feel myself starting to slip into one of those old patterns or one of those old emotional states. And that really changed my whole experience of like understanding myself and my life and what was possible for me. It was kind of like when I began understanding what the term emotional sobriety meant and realizing it was a possibility to be able to kind of be in direct contact with reality and not have it obscured by all of these layers of self-pathologizing and emotions from the past and triggers reemerging. And even just realizing that was possible was humongous for me at that point.
Yeah. So my story is like, it was when I had 9 years sober was when I realized that what I was experiencing in relationships was complex PTSD and emotional flashbacks. And I couldn't figure out why I literally felt like I was going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, like when a guy didn't text me back or, you know, I dated a guy for less than a month and he ghosted me. And like my reaction was as if my husband of 30 years had just like, you know, tragically died. And so it was connecting that feeling back to the feeling that I felt as a little girl when I'd wake up in the middle of the night and feel like I was going to die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. So how would you experience like super intense emotional flashbacks?
Yes, it's interesting actually, because I had different flavors of them. And I imagine that's not super uncommon, but I would have some that were very activating. So where I would have either like a sense of terror and doom.
What typically trigger those?
It depends. It could be like, so for me, big triggers have always been, for a kind of variety of reasons I won't go into, anything related to home invasion in particular triggers an extreme like terror response in my body. And I was very hypersensitive and like hypervigilant to any weird noises, anything, especially if I was home alone or in like a strange place, like an Airbnb or a hotel or something. I would just not be able to tune out tiny noises that could be totally normal that would put my body into this super hypervigilant state. So that was one I would experience. And it took me a long time to realize that was even a trigger. And I wasn't just kind of a paranoid person. So I'd have terror triggers, anger triggers. So I had a long pattern of just suppressing anger. And then in romantic relationships in particular, every once in a while, it was like all of it would just break through at once. And I started recognizing those emotional flashbacks actually as how they showed up visually. So if I was in an anger flashback, I would notice that like my visual field almost felt like it was shaking. And that was how I would start to identify that I was in this state of, I have to get all the anger out at once or else, you know, I'm not going to be okay. And then the hardest ones to recognize, I think, actually were ones that were more related to feelings of hopelessness and depression. So I would also have emotional flashbacks that would put me in this state of kind of feeling like I had no connection to the outside world, to other people, like there was never going to be a way to connect in any meaningful way to others. And those were the hardest ones to recognize because they were so subtle and they were at first sometimes difficult to distinguish from just like being in a low mood. And the triggers around them were a little trickier too. So they came in lots of flavors and they still do, right? Like they're not totally gone. And I imagine they'll never be totally gone, but the process of getting to recognize them quicker and name them more like accurately over time has been humongous because it means that that process of shaming myself for having those feelings can be totally done away with. And I can actually just be with them and allow them to exist in whatever way they need to until they don't need to anymore.
And so what was your relationship pattern? Like what was your story?
Well,
I've read it, but was it your very first book was like the like series of essays like on romantic stuff?
Yeah, I wrote that when I was, I think like 22, 23.
Oh, you were a baby. Before you even realized any of this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, my pattern in relationships. I mean, I really latched on early on in the attachment healing work to the fearful avoidant label, which has this very like push-pull kind of dynamic to it in all relationships. So for a lot of my adult life, like I was in an 8-year relationship between the ages of 17 and 24, 25, that was very like on and off, push, pull. And I did not understand anything I was feeling was kind of the main thing.
Go like, read her book if you want to hear about it, right?
I do feel like I could only write essays at that point in my life because there was no through line to my own emotional state. Like one day I would feel one thing, the next day I'd feel something totally different. And I could
one of the chapters was on like if you're like afraid that you're never going to meet the one or something. And it's just like, that's okay. And I'm like, fuck you. No, it's not. You'll be good.
That's one of the essays I do still like, actually.
Sorry to interrupt you. So that was an 8-year relationship.
Yeah, I had a couple of long-term relationships, actually. So I was always, I mean, one thing that I always found a bit tricky about my psychology was like, I definitely err pretty far on the avoidantly attached side of the spectrum. And I'm pretty social as a person. Mm. So I often found myself getting into these relationships because I like being around people. Like I'm just kind of more extroverted as a person. And I would often kind of end up in these relationships where I couldn't tell, if I'm being totally honest, like, do I want to be in a romantic relationship or do I just like hanging out? And I think that actually got me into
just
a lot
want a friend.
Of trouble. Yeah. Yes.
Is that not how it works?
Well, I think that's one part of how it works. And there's supposed to be a bunch of other stuff is what I've learned.
So you say you're extroverted, but wasn't your thing like before? Oh, you are. What was your other book? Is this Myers-Briggs stuff?
Myers-Briggs. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you? I'm just looking over here. So you're what? You're an ENFP?
That's the label I identified with for a long time. And Myers-Briggs as a system, it's funny, doesn't hit for me the same way as it used to. But yeah, for a long time, it really did. And it's kind of interesting because looking back on it now, I feel like I kind of built that into this narrative in my head where I got really into personality systems for a while. And I used that as like a reason why I wasn't able to connect with, in particular, my family. Like I was like, they're all of this personality category. And I'm of this other personality category. And it was in some ways kind of this lifeboat for me where I went, well, if it's just a personality difference, then maybe there's not something deeply wrong with me. I just happen to be more like this and other people happen to be more like this. And then when I started doing all of this work and noticing how many of the patterns of personality that I just kind of put on myself were actually starting to change as I did more work on myself, then I became less enamored with the personality systems, but also a little bit more skeptical of why I was so excited about them in the first place. And I don't think that like there's anything wrong with loving personality systems and getting to know yourself through them. But I do think for me, there was an element of wanting to put myself in a particular box and believe that it was just an inborn personality thing as opposed to
your entire personality was a trauma response. Yeah. Like when you realize that, you're like, oh, shit. Newsflash. So as I said to you before we started that you just did a video on attachment that I think is one of the best breakdowns on attachment that I've ever seen and really provides so much depth and nervous system insight in a way that like I haven't ever seen before. Mm. So where I wanted to start was, you know, I think often we think kind of in simple terms of, you know, an anxious attacher means somebody who had parents that were inconsistent, avoidant as having parents that are rejecting, and then like disorganized as like having both. But can you talk about how our attachment styles are formed based upon how our caregivers responded to us when we were in distress, and specifically speaking to like the whole window of tolerance thing?
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, the things that you just said about the kind of early environments that each style tends to develop in, that is totally accurate. And I think that a lot of things that you might read or find online about attachment theory kind of stop there. Like they look at, okay, what kind of an early environment did you have? And then here's what you're going to be like as an adult. But they leave out a lot of what happens in between, which is what I started getting really, really curious about. So if, let's say, you're starting out in any of those developmental conditions, what does that actually mean about your development? So how do you actually grow into a different person with a differently regulated nervous system based on what happens to you early on? So kind of what I start going over in that video that you're referencing is not only how your early attachment system correlates to what's going to happen later in life, but how, like, the mechanisms of how it develops. So one of the main things to kind of keep in mind in that category is that when we're really young, so when we are babies and toddlers, we don't really have any real capacity for self-regulation. So we learn when to intervene and when to tend to our own distress based on what our parents do. So based on the point at which they intervene, that becomes kind of what our body learns as the point to intervene in our own distress. So there are kind of general trends in terms of what happens if you grow up in different environments. So I'll start off with anxious.
I have, and this actually might not apply to you, but I have a condiment attachment style theory that's like proven to be like pretty accurate. And that is, anxious attachers really love their condiments, and avoidance are like things plain or maybe like a little bit of mustard. And it's like proven to be like 95% accurate. But it sounds like how you dressed your salad that maybe this
doesn't apply.
Do you love condiments? Okay. Well, yeah. you're an outlier.
Yeah. Mayo in particular, though, I can leave almost any other condiment, but mayo gets me.
Okay. Okay. Well, I don't know. Just mayo? If you can leave any other condiment, maybe. Okay. Kind of applies.
I'm going to start thinking about that now anytime I'm eating.
Ask people. I'm telling you, yeah. It's accurate.
Okay. There are certain tells like that. I do believe in stuff like that.
So if you're anxious.
Yes.
Sorry.
If you're anxious as you are overdressing your food as a child, something yes. that's also is going to be happening mm-hmm. is that usually you're going to be having the experience as you grow up of not getting regulation from your caregivers until you're already in a reasonable amount of distress. Because generally those who grow up in environments that tend to lead to anxious attachment systems later on in life, that might mean that they have one parent who is just super stressed, super busy. They might be the youngest of several kids, or they might have a parent who, for whatever reason, is just not able to stay that attuned. And so what tends to happen is that in order to get your parents' attention, if you're growing up this way, you have to learn to really hone in on what is happening internally and learn to get louder and louder and more expressive about it, because that is the only way that you're going to get your needs met when you're too young to find any way to meet them on your own. But basically what that's teaching the nervous system is that anytime you are in distress, it's time to almost feel meta distress about your own distress, because mm-hmm. your nervous system is automatically going to be going, okay, how do I ramp up the volume on this? Because if I just express it at the volume it actually exists at, it's not going to get heard. It's going to get ignored. My needs aren't going to get met. And this is super adaptive when you are a kid growing up in that environment. It is the thing that keeps us alive. But then as adults, what that often leads to is an inability to actually be present with one's own distress when it's in kind of mild to moderate range. And instead, this feeling of panic about one's own distress will come online. Mm-hmm. And then the attention starts getting hijacked, and where it's going to naturally turn towards is, who can I get to come be close to me and help me soothe this distress. And so a lot of the time when I'm talking to anxious attachers who are feeling very preoccupied, and we often use that word to describe the anxious experience, anxious preoccupation, with generally it's a love interest or someone they're attached to, and how to keep that person close and how to keep the attention on them. Something I always like to check in on is, what else is going on in your life right now? Like, what else are you feeling stressed out about, and how present are you with that? Because a lot of the time that kind of preoccupation response with needing to keep someone close is actually happening because the nervous system is aware that there's some type of tension internally that's been building that it doesn't know how to relieve on its own. It doesn't know. We haven't taught ourselves or learned how to be present with that and do that self-soothing. Mm-hmm. So the attention works in tandem with the nervous system, right? And it starts directing the thoughts towards, how do I achieve comfort or keep someone else close, as opposed to, how do I put the attention that I need on my own distress?
Do you think that separation anxiety as a kid is like a manifestation of this, of like trying to get your parents' attention?
Yes. So actually where attachment theory originally came from was basically they call it the strange situation experiment, where they were looking specifically at what children did when they were separated from their caregivers.
Yep.
And anxious children tend to become very highly distressed, both when their parent leaves, as well as when they come back, actually, which is interesting.
That is really interesting. Huh? Yeah, because that's what started things for me, was like developing separation anxiety. And that's when I went to a therapist for the first time. Okay, let's talk about avoidant.
Yeah. So the avoidant experience is almost opposite, actually, in that they learned that distress is not important to pay attention to. And in fact, it can actually be really detrimental to receiving care. So often what happens in avoidant households is that expressions of vulnerability or of desire for closeness and care and nurturing beyond one's physical needs being met are met with hostility and rejection fairly consistently by the parents. And so I think what people tend to think about this is that the child makes this very conscious calculation that goes, okay, I will not express my vulnerabilities because they're bad. But what actually happens is the nervous system just kind of starts hiding those for us. Like, it's not a conscious thought process. It's more that when distress arises in the nervous system, it often doesn't really make it into conscious awareness for the child who's growing up avoidant. So when you ask those children how they're doing and they say, great, good, awesome, even if they're in distress, they don't think they're lying to you a lot of the time. But similar to how the anxious attacher starts naturally focusing on, how do I keep other people close when they're in distress without realizing that their distress is present, the avoidant attacher is more likely to start thinking about how to keep themselves looking good or acceptable in the eyes of others when they're in distress, because that's what allows them, or what once allowed them, to be in their parents' good graces when they were behaving the way like a good boy or girl would behave, or when they were doing whatever it was in their family role that got them that approval. That's what their attention is going to be oriented towards. So when the avoidant attacher is in distress, they often don't notice it, because their nervous system is working really hard to keep that out of their awareness, but they're still going to be feeling it. And they're usually going to be feeling an increased kind of desperation and pressure and stress to achieve something, or like become some idealized version of themselves, which is not what they would call it in their own head. So it's even a bit tricky to talk about this in language that like breaks all the way
through. How would they view it in their head?
I can just speak firsthand for myself. It feels as though I am chronically falling short of what I believe are perfectly reasonable expectations for myself. And then when I check in with the outside world, those are not at all the kinds of expectations other people are holding themselves to, which it took me a really, really long time to learn. And still I have to kind of chronically learn. So it's funny, because it's that thing where nobody who's actually perfectionistic identifies as a perfectionist because they think they're not good enough. But I think that perfectionism is really closely related in a lot of cases to avoidant attachment. Just this idea of like, I have to be chronically working to improve myself, to get better, to achieve things that makes it kind of okay for me to exist and to be in connection with other people. But the attention is not explicitly focused on relationships. So they're doing this kind of subconsciously, but they're not thinking the end goal is, I'll be good enough to be in relationships with people. But that's kind of what the nervous system believes. So when the pressure turns on for avoidance, often what happens is that they withdraw from relationships because there's this belief that if there's anything I'm feeling that is vulnerable or distressing or messy or not perfect, I need to go be alone to deal with that. And then once I am okay again, then I can kind of come back to the world and show people the best side of me, which is the only side that anybody ever wants to see, of course. So it's a very different process for the avoidant attacher, I think, to work with attachment wounds because they're not as explicitly linked to relationships as they might be for the anxious attacher who really feels that kind of pain in relationships specifically.
Yeah, it's miserable. So that's really interesting because you're almost talking about, because when you were talking about the distress for the avoidant, so we're more so talking about when you're feeling distress outside of the relationship, like distress in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. I think it's like important to make that distinction. Really interesting. Huh. That's fascinating. Okay. And then how would this differ with a disorganized attachment?
So disorganized can mean a lot of different things, but essentially the way that I kind of define disorganization just on like a purely functional level is all anxious attachers will do some avoidant like things and all avoidants will do some anxious like things. But with the fearful or the disorganized attachment style, essentially what's happening is that your nervous system is always trying to figure out, it's internalized at some point, that sometimes it's really important to pay attention to internal signals of distress or pain or whatever it is. And other times it's really important to downregulate away from them and shove them down and not attend to them. And so your nervous system is kind of chronically trying to figure out what situation am I in when? So is now the time to pay attention to my distress signals, or is now the time to shame myself for them and shove them down, which will be more conscious of a process for the fearful avoidant than the dismissive avoidant. The dismissive avoidant's nervous system kind of pushes down the distress automatically. With the fearful avoidant, they're likely to experience a little bit more of it because they've learned sometimes that's important, but then they're going to shame themselves for it a lot of the time too. So there's this really chronic kind of war against the self that is often happening inside of people with disorganized attachment systems, fearful avoidant systems, where it's really hard to figure out consciously a lot of the time for these people when it's time to pay attention to my emotions, when it's time to share them, and when it's time not to. And that will, to some extent, be present for all of the styles, including secure, which is kind of the style that gets forgotten because it's what happens if you have healthy
nurturing environment. Nobody can relate that's listening. So I think this isn't the podcast they listen to.
But yeah, generally I say that like, if you have a lot of active distress in your life that comes online by virtue of the fact that you are sometimes completely tuned out from your emotional experiences and can't seem to feel what you think you should be feeling or find a way to connect to people in the way that you want to be connected. But then other times it feels like there is a very distressing amount of emotion in your system and your life is almost being chronically disrupted by the fact that those two things are pulling you in different directions quite frequently. There's a high chance you're dealing with something in the disorganization category, even if it's not a full-blown disorganized style. I kind of just informally categorize it as anyone who's really struggling with the back and forth between those two states probably falls somewhere into that category.
And so why is this important to understand, like from a healing perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question.
All right, shitshows, did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps? It affects 1 in 3 adults and especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, brain fog, weakness, brittle nails. But the problem is that most people don't realize that low iron may be the cause of these issues. That's why I'm here to tell you about Citerol from Pharma Nutra. This is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrose technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while also avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea, constipation, and all that fun stuff. It is clinically proven to be comparable to IV iron and is formulated with just 2 ingredients, iron and vitamin C. It's vegan, allergen-free, gluten-free. You can take it anytime, anywhere. So if you are that 1 out of 3 with an iron deficiency, head to pharmanutra-us.
PHARS.com and use code ADULTCHILD for 10% off your first order. That is PHARMANUTRA-US.com, promo code ADULTCHILD for 10% off today. All right, Chichos, did you know that scientists now openly say that your gut is the cornerstone of your health? And it's not just about digestion, okay? The gut literally affects everything from your energy levels to mood to weight management and even your longevity. However, an imbalanced microbiome can sneakily sabotage you with constant bloating, sluggish energy, and those stubborn extra pounds that you just can't lose no matter what. But here's the kicker. Fixing your gut bacteria isn't rocket science. It is the game changer for reclaiming your vibe and living your best damn life. And that is where Bioma steps in, delivering powerhouse supplements like their flagship probiotics for killer digestion and weight control, the Feminine Health Symbiotic to keep things balanced down there, and menopause support to crush hot flashes and mood swings. Their science-backed trio of prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics work like a gut reset button, all in vegan, tasteless capsules with a no BS 14-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it risk-free, okay? So go to gobioma.com/adultchild today for an extra 15% off your order. That is gobioma.com/adultchild and get an extra 15% off. So Chichos, the holidays sure do sneak up fast, so it's never too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it instead of scrambling at the last minute and just finding whatever the hell you can find. And Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Good looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. So I just got a friend of mine a laptop cat scratch. Scratching pad. So it's a scratching pad that looks like a laptop because her cat, like mine, likes to constantly sit on her computer. It's probably not going to help with that problem, but it was hilarious and I had to get it. And then I got for myself, it's called a couch caddy. So confession, I'm constantly losing my phone and the remote in between the couch cushions. And so this is this like beautiful wooden thing that kind of drapes over the arm of the couch. And it has a designated spot where I can put my phone, the remote, a drink. It's the shit. I'm obsessed. And so Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms to dads, kids, teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard football fans to foodies. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else, and I mean it. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/adultchild. That's uncommongoods.com/adultchild for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I think that it's not actually as obvious as it seems, in that a lot of the time, the goal that people come into the kind of healing process with, so to speak, can in some ways actually be an extension of this patterning that they have internalized.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'll explain what that means. So like, I think a lot of people come into this work from, let's say, the anxious side of the spectrum, thinking, if I can just learn to chill out a little bit and be a more relaxed partner, then finally, I'm going to get into this relationship that is going to save me, and it's going to fix all of my distress forever, and I'm going to feel good forever. And it's this kind of driving fantasy about healing work in and of itself that can actually lead you to a place where you're kind of trying to get better at your own strategy for self-avoidance, as opposed to actually connecting with the self, which in my opinion is where a lot of, if not all of the real healing work actually happens, where we're able to be present with whatever is happening, accepting of whatever is happening, even when we hate it or wish it were different, and be able to give ourselves a more robust experience of our entire lives, because we're not terrified of certain inner states, like feeling separate from the people we love and what happens in us when that happens. But this can happen on any side of the spectrum. So on the avoidance side, having a secure attachment style or being a person who is healed can become kind of another goal that you're just endlessly working towards, and deciding that you're not going to be present with yourself. You're not going to get to know yourself until you have achieved this perfect state. And admittedly, that was my healing journey for like years and years, was just trying to act more and more perfect and look at, okay, what would an absolutely perfect partner be like? And putting more and more pressure on myself to take the right actions while actually staying disconnected from myself. So I think that I would not have said this several years ago, but when it comes to working with our attachment systems, I actually think the most important part of this work is just recognizing when we're having an attachment response that is taking us away from the present moment, which is generally what they do, because if we're panicked at either feeling disconnected from other people or feeling disconnected from the version of ourselves that we need to think of ourselves as in order to stay regulated, we're missing out on a lot of our lives with this kind of strategizing process that we might not realize we're consciously doing of how do I get back into connection with this other person, or how do I become perfect and fix all my flaws? And that robs us of like a lot of the good parts of life that, in my opinion, are kind of like the best thing you could possibly get out of healing, is being able to actually be present with your entire life as it's happening, you know, to a reasonable extent. But I think that knowing where you're starting from gives you a lot of information about where you are likely to kind of flip into this fantasy version of either yourself or your relationships or your life, and then how you can kind of bring yourself back to what's actually happening if you notice yourself doing that chronically.
Do you think that there's anything else important to note as far as attachment and your nervous system? Because I mean, you've talked about like how we handle distress, and I mean, we just so often focus on just how it impacts and shows up in relationships. But do you think that there is like something key there that like doesn't get talked about or addressed, like when we think about attachment or attachment styles?
Yes. You brought up the term window of tolerance earlier, and I didn't bring it up in my descriptions of the three insecure attachment styles, but it was a term that's coined by Dr. Dan Siegel. And basically, the window of tolerance is kind of the nervous system state within which we are relatively present and at choice about what we're doing with our lives and how we're choosing to interact with other people and ourselves. And basically, if you're insecurely attached or have, especially if you have complex PTSD symptoms, you're going to spend a lot of your life outside of that window of tolerance without realizing it. So being in one of those like fight, flight, freeze, or fawn responses might occupy a lot of your time without realizing it. So you're not actually making choices from a kind of calm and regulated place about who you want to be close to, what you want to do with your life, what goals you want to pursue. And you might not even realize that for a really long time. And a big way that I like to think about nervous system regulation that I don't see talked about a lot is being proactive about what is going to flip you into those responses. So I see a lot of stuff online around how to basically downregulate yourself from like a fight response, or how to upregulate yourself from a freeze response. But what I don't see a lot of people focusing on, that I started focusing really heavily on over time, was how do I start to notice the patterns of what flips me into those responses in the first place? And for a lot of people, that is really, really related to attachment patterning. And how can I start being a little bit more conscious about how I'm designing my lifestyle, as well as the situations I'm putting myself in, to make sure that I can give myself the best possible chance of being within that window of regulation much more often? Because also, that's where we're going to learn the best. It's where we are going to adopt new skills the quickest. If we're doing any sort of healing work, that's the place from which we're really actually going to be able to internalize what we're learning. So I think that looking at your attachment patterns and your triggers that might be very related to your attachment patterns can help you predict where you're more likely to flip into a dysregulated response. And I think that there can be a lot of merit in just environmental design in the healing process, and making sure that you're able to be in environments more often than not, especially if you're rewiring that kind of core, very vulnerable stuff, where you're not going to be frequently flipping outside of that window of tolerance and into a response where you're not really at choice, you know, in the truest sense of the term, about how you're going to be responding or acting.
Could you give some examples?
Yeah. One thing I feel like it's important to kind of highlight is that a lot of my understanding of attachment comes from a model called the dynamic maturational model of attachment, which looks at our attachment systems actually kind of like the fight or flight system, where they're—
Can you say it one more time?
The dynamic maturational model of attachment. Okay. So this was a system that was created by a woman named Patricia Crittenden, who worked originally with John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth, who were kind of the original parents of attachment theory. And then she went on to do a lot of work in studying what happens to our attachment responses as we grow up and develop. And one of her main contributions to attachment theory was proposing this idea that basically our attachment responses come online the most strongly when we are threatened in any way. So a lot of us have the experience of feeling very secure and very regulated and very calm in some scenarios. And then in other scenarios, it's like, oh my God, I'm so doing that anxious attachment thing or that avoidant attachment thing and not really knowing why that is. Lost the question I was trying to answer now.
I asked for examples of like avoiding your triggers or designing your environment to not go into those states.
Yes. Awesome. Okay. So I think the easiest example I can give of this is, let's say you have an anxious attachment style and you notice that you are very frequently triggered when dating. Like all of these anxious triggers start coming up as soon as you start getting close to someone. You might also want to look at things like, am I intentionally getting close to people who are kind of mirroring those patterns that I'm very used to of not really paying attention to my distress until it's at like a 7, 8, 9 out of 10? And if that's the case, and if I am just kind of endlessly repeating this same situation that I grew up in, what might it mean about the way that I'm relating to myself? And if I started relating to myself differently, so if I started noticing I'm at like a 5, 6 level of distress, and I can notice that by paying attention to my thinking and noticing like, oh, wow, I'm really preoccupied with whatever this guy I just went on a couple of dates with is thinking about me. Can I kind of pause and use that as a checkpoint where I can look at what's happening inside of myself, try to be like a little bit more present with myself, and then ask myself the question that a secure person might ask themselves at that 5 or 6 level of distress, which is something like, is this relationship feeling good for me? So instead of just kind of flipping immediately into that preoccupied with the other thinking, can I use my capacity to have that connection with myself to check in and go, is this a situation I want to keep putting myself in? Like if I'm really not getting what I need from this person, or if I really feel like my bids for connection aren't being met, can I actually really value that and try to be more intentional about getting into connections with people who are meeting me at the level of reciprocity that I want? And generally, you can learn one of two things from that. You can learn, yes, I can do that, which is kind of the ideal outcome. But you can also learn, oh, maybe I'm actually putting a lot of my distress on these relationships before maybe the relationship is strong enough to bear that.
Yeah, of course. So
that, yeah. But it takes that kind of looking at the environment you're putting yourself in and really questioning, like, why is it that I'm continuously getting triggered? And can I deal with that like a little bit more consciously or with a little bit more awareness? And is it actually possible for me to, for a while, make sure that I'm not putting myself in environments where I'm getting constantly triggered and anxious and overwhelmed by the possibility that someone might be thinking something negative about me, in order for that healing work to actually happen, for our nervous systems to be calm enough that we can actually internalize and learn new things, we have to make sure that we're not putting ourselves in situations that are just chronically re-triggering us. And it will happen to some extent because you can't just avoid triggers forever, but it does really help to bring into one's awareness, I think, as we're doing the healing work, when am I feeling overwhelmed in my nervous system? And are there ways that I can try to take some of the pressure off of it while I'm trying to learn new things? And then of course, once you've learned, you can go back out into the wild and practice your new skills. But there is a certain amount of almost like bubbling in some cases that needs to happen for our systems to be calm enough to learn those new things in the first place.
I can give like a real life example of that for me is, you know, like when I'm first starting to talk to a guy, I won't engage in a question. Like if somebody's like, hey, how's your day? I'll ask back, how was your day? But I won't carry a conversation further. I try to let them carry the conversation because I know what will happen. Like if I send something, it's like I'm putting myself in a position to where I'm going to start thinking those things, however long it takes for them to get back to me, of like, oh, did I say too much? You know, am I coming across as needy, pathetic, or desperate? You know, so it's like not even putting myself in a position to where I can get triggered in that way.
Yes. Okay. So this is actually super jogging my memory of something else I forgot to mention in this whole spiel, which is what it sounds like you're talking about to me is you're being protective over yourself. Like,
yeah,
you're
protecting really my nervous system.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what am I capable of handling right now in terms of possible responses from this other person and making that negotiation? And one of the things that I think is also can be heavily related to attachment is there's kind of two ways that we keep kids safe in the world. And one is we comfort them when something goes wrong. So we tend to their emotions when something's stressful or difficult. And the other is we protect them. So we try to keep them out of situations that are going to be kind of overwhelming or difficult in a way that doesn't really grow them or is too much for them too soon. And then as adults, a lot of us have learned to care for ourselves in one of those two ways, and we need to kind of even it out with the other. So a lot of anxious attachers will do a lot of seeking comfort, but they won't do a lot of self-protection. So they will kind of routinely go into those scenarios where they're open-hearted and vulnerable and want to put it all out there and get hurt over and over again and not internalize that it's actually time to put up a few earlier boundaries or kind of inch into things more slowly. And so that self-protection piece is what has to start coming into play in order for them to feel less hurt less often. You can't always avoid pain, but there's a degree to which you cannot set yourself up for it continuously too. And then on the other side, avoidant attachers are generally pretty, almost too good in some cases at self-protection. So they will kind of instinctively withdraw themselves from any scenarios that might cause them pain or might even have a chance that they're going to get hurt or embarrassed or whatever it is. And what they actually need to learn to do is to put themselves in more of those situations and then also learn to comfort themselves when they go wrong. So looking at where we're starting from can also give us a lot of information of what's going to really help us grow based on what we might need to kind of balance out our natural tendencies with. So I think that's just a beautiful example of what can happen in healing from the anxious style as you start learning, like, actually, it matters if my feelings are getting hurt here, you know, and I'm going to take the care to protect myself from that. I'm not going to put it on other people entirely. I'm also going to make sure that, like, hey, I'm watching out for myself. And then on the more avoidant side of the spectrum, it might actually be more of a journey of learning to put yourself out there more and take responsibility for attending to your hurt if and when it happens, rather than just kind of withdrawing indefinitely from things that might be upsetting. But you have to understand where you're starting from in order to get the right treatment, so to speak, for yourself.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what an example would be as far as like being mindful of your environment to not get triggered when it comes to being avoidant?
It can be a lot harder to recognize for avoidance, which I feel a lot of empathy for always. But for myself, I really notice now at this point in my life, perfectionistic thought loops. So when I'm being incredibly self-critical, incredibly judgmental of myself, and holding myself to really high standards in a way that just kind of feels like it kind of manifests for me as like almost feeling like I can't breathe, like I'm holding my breath as I go through my day-to-day life because I'm so stressed about how I'm not working hard enough or meeting my own goals or whatever. For me, that's usually a signal that I am actually not in connection enough in my life. So I developed this idea in my head that lives in my nervous system that until I'm perfect and getting everything perfectly right, until I look perfect, act perfect, have the perfect thing to say at every time, I'm not going to be accepted if I try to connect with everybody. So I need to kind of keep my head down, focus on getting my work done or whatever it is that I've identified as like the challenge I'm rising to at the moment. And if I follow that train for long enough, it starts to feel really isolating, lonely, depressing. I've struggled with depression on and off throughout my entire life. And learning to see that kind of state as a cue that I might actually be avoiding a lot of situations that would be really connecting and growth oriented for me because I'm afraid of coming across as not good enough or like I'm going to be taking time and attention away from some goal I have. That state and that thought process together are at this point in my life a signal for me that I need to stop. I need to go see some people, be in connection, realize that I can be in connection, even though maybe I don't look exactly how I want to look right now. I don't have the exact thing going on with my work or whatever that I want to tell people about, and staying associated to like, okay, look, I'm here. I'm in connection with people. I'm imperfect. They are not dying. I am not dying. I have to almost like exposure therapy myself over and over again in life in that department. And that helps me get acquainted to the fact that interpersonal comfort is possible. I can talk to people about what I'm going through and they're not going to die and I'm not going to die because everything isn't perfect when I'm telling them about how my life is. And so that's that piece that needs to come in around comfort. Like I can be doing whatever I want with my life and my goals and my plans, but I don't have to wait until I get there to have connection and to be close to people. I can get comfort en route, especially when it starts feeling really challenging en route, which is when the avoidants are most likely to start self-isolating. Like the more stress they're under, the more they're going to isolate, which is a really tricky downward spiral that can be less obvious than the anxious spiral.
So this is really fascinating to me. And I'm wondering, like, because I definitely know anxious attachers that are overachiever perfectionists, but is there something unique about the kind of like avoidant perfectionism, approval seek, not, I guess more so like overachieving? Like, is there like a unique like twinge to it?
Yes. It's actually so tricky to do this linguistically because I think that actually,
this is really interesting to me.
Yeah. Anxious attachers, I think, are going to be more conscious about all of this when it shows up in their psyche because they are so aware that they want connection. So if any of these things are happening for the anxious attacher, which they very much can, they're also much more likely to be conscious for them and for them to be hyper aware of the fact that, for example, they're afraid of rejection. With the avoidant, the tricky part is that avoidants are not going to be very conscious of all of this. It's going to be what the nervous system kind of naturally does and not what they are thinking consciously about. So this is very specific and tricky, but basically, I think that when an anxious attacher is trying to figure out if they're in an attachment response, it's often very obvious because they're overtly thinking about what they're anxious about.
Yeah. And it's like the most miserable feeling in your body ever.
Yes, totally. Totally. And then I remember, like, I feel like this can be summed up by this post I saw on an attachment forum once where someone was like, when an avoidant person is avoiding you, what are they thinking about? Like, are they thinking about all the things they hate about you? Like, et cetera, et cetera. No, it's the total opposite. Like, that's the thing they're not thinking about. Like, they're thinking about anything other than those kind of like vulnerable, intimate, connection-oriented, relational things. And that's kind of the point. Like, the other stuff is a distraction from that, that takes the body and the nervous system out of that kind of people-oriented, attachment-oriented space where they're so uncomfortable and puts them into a kind of like more relaxed version of reality where everything is ordered more logically and just makes clean sense and emotions aren't coloring everything. And that place feels so safe and kind of calm relative to the alternative. And so I think most avoidant attachers, I imagine, would not at all identify as perfectionists consciously, would not say like, I'm trying to get everything right in life so that people will accept me. I think that's almost the opposite of their conscious thought process in a lot of cases. And yet it's often what's driving things under the surface. So it's this overall aversion to receiving any type of nurturance or caretaking. So whereas the anxious attacher or those on that side of the spectrum are kind of always a little bit in the back of their minds, nervous that people are going to forget about them or not pay attention to them or not see their vulnerabilities. The total opposite is happening all the time in the avoidant attacher's mind, where they're always a little bit on edge that they're accidentally going to say something that makes them seem like they don't have everything under control and that someone's going to be concerned about them or try to help them in some way, which is for a lot of avoidant attachers then feels like a burden because they have to pretend they're appreciating the help while actually resisting it and trying to solve all their problems on their own. So it just is a lot trickier to consciously identify avoidant attachment. I think it's easiest to identify it through the lack of what ends up happening. Like, are you ending up feeling kind of alone and isolated a lot in life, even if you really want close relationships? Do you tend to feel really intense, overwhelming pressure in close relationships because you haven't learned that you can actually take things from them emotionally? And so as much as I sometimes don't love the word avoidant attachment, it is kind of apt in that way. Like, you end up kind of having to see it in the negative space as opposed to feeling it being super like there and present, like it often is for the anxious attacher when they're having a strong withdrawal response.
I mean, I've definitely gotten like comment, like, I always feel like it would be easier to be avoidant, but I know it's not true, but just feels so much more overtly painful to be anxious.
I think it's actually kind of fair to say that it is in a lot of ways. And, you know, you can make the very diplomatic argument that like all pains are different pains. And I agree. And there's this kind of very dull pain that a lot of avoidance go through of feeling disconnected from people, disconnected from themselves and their emotional states. And that comes with a ton of its own stuff. But it is literally true that the nervous system of anxious attachers are much more frequently activated into some sort of like really distressing emotional state, that they are more frequently just experiencing conscious present moment distress, and that they really struggle to feel like those states ever get like truly all the way through relieved. And I think that it would actually be kind of a bad faith thing to not acknowledge that, and to not acknowledge that it's just incredibly painful by default, like the nervous system.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you.
But I mean, like literally, like the nervous system is literally has learned as a survival strategy to focus on and amplify pain. Like that.
Yeah. I wish I had learned to just numb out, man. Sounds nice. Maybe I wouldn't have become an alcoholic then, right?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You see addictive tendencies on both sides of the spectrum.
I was just about to ask.
But yeah, you'll see it on both sides.
That's a family affair.
Yeah.
So what healing modalities have been most impactful for you in your own journey?
Yeah, great question. So for me, actually, a lot of the modalities that have helped me are ones that kind of get me out of freeze. So that's where a lot of my own wounding lived, was in the place of like, anytime I felt something that felt inappropriate or I was worried about something relationally for a lot of my life, I would just kind of go into this kind of like freeze and withdraw pattern. So for me, a lot of the modalities that have helped me have been ones that actually encourage me to really focus on and take seriously my own emotions, which is sort of an opposite healing pattern that a lot of other people go through. But philosophies like, so authentic relating and radical honesty are two relational philosophies that basically get people very aware of what's happening for them in their bodies and their emotional systems, and then encourage them to express it very directly. Both modalities have their like pros and cons, but I think those two have actually been the most powerful for me, especially developing communities of people who I just kind of socially engage with who are practicing these skills all the time.
Can you explain them a little bit more, like what authentic relating?
Yeah. So authentic relating is basically, you know, it's fine. I don't actually know its origin story, but at this point in time, it is a series of practices. So kind of like relational games, they actually overtly call them, that you can play that get you to be more aware of what's happening in your emotional state in connection with someone else, and then being able to communicate that clearly. So they kind of look at communication as happening on different levels all of the time. So I'm going to try not to butcher this model. Authentic relating talks about the informational level of connecting, which we tend to think of as more like small talk, like just, oh, I like the, you know, leaves behind you right now. They're really pretty. And then the personal level, which is more like, oh, when I'm looking at those leaves, I notice I feel kind of like calm. They remind me of the tree in the backyard of my home, whatever. And then the relational level is in connection with you. I notice this coming up inside of my body. So I notice myself feeling kind of like nervous or questioning myself and what I'm saying. And the whole philosophy, in my opinion, does a really good job at helping people be more honest about like how we're actually impacting each other as people sitting in the same room, talking to each other, which for avoidance does not come naturally at all. If we even recognize those thoughts in our brain in the first place, it tends to be a very against the norm kind of pattern. But for me, learning to become aware of all of that, both what's happening inside of my inner world when I'm alone with myself, and then especially when I'm in connection with other people, has totally changed the way that I relate to myself and others, and has also allowed me to kind of understand a lot of confusions that were happening in my inner world. Like, okay, I have these category of things labeled as bad. So I notice if I start paying attention to what's happening in my inner state when I'm talking to you, there are certain things maybe I would just naturally filter out. And the more attention I start placing on those things, the more I realize like, oh yeah, I filter that out in a lot of my relationships. Like I have this history of maybe like failed romantic relationships where I could never tell someone I was angry, or I could never tell someone I was hurt by something. And what might have happened if I had became kind of this growing question for me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then radical honesty.
Radical honesty. I always kind of give the caveat that I think it's got a tricky history, that the company itself is kind of, they've gone
like a cult.
I think it started in a way that was a little too intense. I'll say that. is my understanding of its conception. Not necessarily cult-like, but just like a little too radical as a philosophy with not necessarily enough trauma awareness. But basically the idea behind radical honesty is very similar to authentic relating, but with more of an edge. So radical honesty encourages people to get in touch in particular with anger and attraction, which for me were two of my absolute most repressed feelings for my entire life.
It's like, fuck you, I think you're hot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. See, you don't need to go. If you know that sentence, you don't need to go. But basically, yeah, it's a similar kind of communication practice where it encourages people to actually upregulate the emotions that are ones they would more naturally downregulate, like feeling really appreciative towards someone, really angry at someone, really frustrated or resentful or attracted to someone, and to bring those into communication. But then also, and this was the part that was really the most powerful for me, to stay associated to your body when you express those things. So in a radical honesty practice, if you said something that I got angry at, I would tell you, I am angry at you for saying this. And then I would immediately turn my attention to, as I'm looking at you and as I'm seeing that kind of hit you, what's happening in my body? Can I feel my heart rate? Can I be aware of how much I am or I'm not breathing? Am I feeling kind of sweaty and clammy? And the point of that part of the practice is that if we are normally very afraid of communicating in certain ways or connecting with people in certain ways, the first thing we're going to do when we try a risky thing is dissociate. We're just going to go somewhere totally else in our minds, in our bodies. And we're not actually going to stay and notice the impact of what's happening and notice like, oh, I told you that thing and I didn't die and you didn't die and you're still standing in front of me. You also didn't run away. And then you can respond with whatever that brings up in you. But the idea is like learning, they don't use this language for it, but for me, it's always been a practice in distress tolerance, getting into those really emotionally tricky places and then learning we can survive it was really, really huge for me in counteracting that shutdown response that used to be very instinctual for me in like high charged emotional situations.
What made it controversial at first? Like,
I think so Brad Blanton, who's the founder of this whole school of thought, basically, he was originally running all of the workshops on it. And then the company got taken over by some other people at a certain point, which in my opinion was great. But my opinion on what Brad was not doing well in the early days was he was kind of adopting this philosophy of like radical self-responsibility that I think could actually be kind of harmful relationally. Like his idea was kind of that if I'm mad at you, I just need to tell you so that I can get back into like a regulated state by having told you that. And I think there's merit to that. And I think if that's kind of where the process ends for you, you're likely to be ruining a whole bunch of relationships left, right, and center by not caring for the impact that your honesty is having on people. So over the years, I've worked with a bunch of people, including a couple of the collaborators I have on the retreats that I run, have radical honesty backgrounds, who have done the work of trying to make the philosophy a lot more trauma-informed. So they're understanding, like, if you're getting people in a room and some of these people come from abusive households or households where like yelling always led to violence, and there are these really strong danger associations with some of this stuff, you have to be mindful of that. You have to contain it super well. And you also have to give the other person who's receiving this expression of, you know, sometimes rage or attraction, which can also be a really triggering one for people. You also have to make a lot of room for their experience until it gets
have some consideration.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not just re-traumatizing people, right?
Yeah. Don't be a dick.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, it's funny because like the philosophy would imply you kind of can be a dick more than you think you can, but you have to care about what happens afterwards. Like if you go through life being a dick to everybody, you're probably going to end up pretty isolated. So
yeah. Don't be a dick for no reason.
Yeah, exactly. Pick your moments.
So what do you have coming up? Like, do you have more retreats scheduled?
I do. I have a retreat in Toronto coming up this fall, one in Australia in November. Yeah. And then another one in Costa Rica that's going to be a week-long retreat, which I'm really excited about, at the end of January.
Cool. And then what's your next video going to be on?
I just filmed one this morning, actually, that kind of goes over, and it, I imagine it will be out by the time you're watching this podcast or listening to it, but on the anxious avoidant spiral and what tends to happen in relationships when the avoidant starts pulling away and it activates the anxious party and what's actually going on for both people in that dynamic, which I see a lot of projections floating around online about what's happening. So I try to do a 360 degree view of that, and we'll see how well I get it.
Never experienced that.
Nobody listening to this podcast has ever experienced that, I'm sure.
Well, thanks. This is awesome. I loved it. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Let it all go. What you-